Hi everyone. I hope you're doing well. It's good to see you. I hope that you've had a wonderful retreat so far. I wish that I could be there with you in person, but I did really enjoy seeing a lot of you 3 weeks ago when I was at home visiting. But anyways, I am recording this a day or two ahead of time because right now, when you're watching this, I am probably in the car driving on my way to church this morning to help with music out in California. But I'm really excited to share this sermon with you. It is one of my personal favorites. It is one that I preached a few months ago out here in California, and it was the conclusion of a series that we had been in on speaking from the margins. And so, as this concluding sermon, I summarize a lot of what we had already talked about. So it's a good sort of taste of what we had been discussing about speaking from the margins. And yeah, I am very excited for this one, and I hope that you are too. So would you please join me in prayer? May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be pleasing in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Who knows? I imagine those were the words ringing in Esther's ears as she wrote her own death sentence with every step she took. Who knows? Every footfall echoed louder and louder as she neared the king's inner court, uninvited. Who knows? Her heart felt like it was pounding outside of her chest. Her hammering heartbeat threatened to drown out the words, who knows? She rounded the last corner, no turning back now. Who knows? She could see through the doorway the king on his throne. Who knows? Was she stepping into mercy or her grave? Who knows? She crossed the threshold. There, in suffocating silence, one moment felt like a lifetime. A hair's breadth between life and death, which would come? Who knows? Esther felt 100 years older in the second it took the king to respond. He extended his scepter, mercy, not death. And it felt like the world sighed in relief. The book of Esther is not for the faint of heart. As entertaining as Esther's story is, and it really is a masterful work of storytelling, a slow, close reading will allow the deeper, heavier themes to seep into the pits of our stomachs. I've titled this sermon, Who Knows? Glass Ceilings and Genocide, to give you a little taste of what we're up against, what Esther is up against this morning. Glass ceilings are a problem of womanhood, and genocide is a problem of ethnicity, and those are the two strands that we'll be paying attention to this morning. But before we lose too much momentum, let's dive back in and rewind to the beginning of the story. King Ahasuerus ruled Persia. A couple translations call him Xerxes. I'm sticking with Ahasuerus. And at the beginning of the book of Esther, Ahasuerus decides to flaunt the riches of the Persian Empire. So for 180 days, he just shows off all the wealth the empire has to offer. And to end those 180 days with a bang, he decides to throw a massive party for everyone in the capital city of Susa. Literally everyone in Susa. All of the men go to King Ahasuerus' party, and all of the women go to Queen Vashti's party. And if you just had the riches of the empire rubbed in your face for the last 6 months or so, you'd be expecting a nice party. And King Ahasuerus does not disappoint. The entire city parties hard for a week. And on the last day of the party, the king is drunk. It says that in the text. And he has a spot of trouble, shall we say, with the queen, Queen Vashti. Without going into detail, he asks her to come over to his party of men in a way that contributes to her objectification and dehumanization, and she refuses. She preaches with her body and strategically does not show up when she is expected to, and for that Ahasuerus banishes Vashti. So now he needs a new queen. He sends out a proclamation into all the empire, and his servants seize a bunch of young women, including the orphan Esther. They capture them, round them up, and cart them off to the palace. The women undergo a year's worth of beauty treatments, and then they each have one night to impress the king. The morning after, they are transferred to another one of the king's harems, one of his harems of concubines, his mistresses, a step lower than wives. The winner gets to become queen, but the losers don't get to go back home. Their lives have been forever disrupted. Their families, their friends, their hopes and dreams just poof. There is no going back. Esther does impress the king in her one night, and she becomes the new queen. But this entire time, though, she never reveals the fact that she's Jewish. She takes on the name Esther so she can pass for Persian, or at least anything other than Jewish. Her Jewish name is Hadassah. What does that mean, to pass for Persian? What kind of code switching does she need to do? She can't openly worship Yahweh, and so she has to at least go through the motions of worshiping Persian gods and goddesses. She doesn't eat kosher, she doesn't observe the Sabbath, she doesn't just distance herself from her culture, she abandons it altogether. She rejects the essence of her identity and sense of self as a survival tactic. She negates her culture and her people and embodies an identity foreign to herself in order to survive. Which tells you that Jews weren't necessarily beloved by the populace, otherwise she would have had no reason to hide. In the Persian palace, she is cut off from her people, and she lives this alienated existence in order to blend in with the dominant center of power. Her disturbing and distressing journey to the throne had been directed by forces outside her control. But now, even as the queen in the palace of the most powerful empire on earth, she does not feel safe in her Jewish skin. And she lives that false self, that capitulation to the dominant center of power, for years before we see her again. So after a few years have gone by, then we meet this guy named Haman. We have no idea why King Ahasuerus decided to suddenly promote Haman to such a high position, essentially his right-hand man. Haman's qualifications are unimportant or non-existent. But for whatever reason, there's Haman. He and Esther's cousin Mordecai don't see quite eye to eye. There's some tension there. So much tension, in fact, that Haman sidles on up to the king because he figured out that Mordecai was a Jew. And Haman says to King Ahasuerus, "So there's this people group in your empire, but they don't really respect you. They don't follow your laws, they follow their own laws. Maybe you should do something about that. And King Ahasuerus replies, oh yeah, you're probably right. What would you suggest? And Haman replies, oh well, kill them all? I mean, just throwing that out there. And King Ahasuerus says, that sounds like a great idea. Let's do it. And so they write up a proclamation to send into all the land that on one specific day, anyone can rob and kill any Jews they can find. But the news of this proposed genocide does not go over well in the scattered Jewish communities, and they weep and lament and fast. Mordecai, to show the seriousness of his grief, puts on sackcloth and pours ashes over his head, an outward sign of the knots in his stomach and in his soul, as if the weeping and wailing wasn't sign enough. And he goes to the palace gate like he sometimes does. And Esther, through her servants, asks what's wrong. Queen Esther did not know about the proclamation of genocide against her own people. The city of Susa is in an uproar about it, but inside the palace, the dominant center of power is quiet and calm. Insulated by the palace walls and isolated from her Jewish heritage, Queen Esther is out of touch. If it wasn't for Mordecai's show of grief, she would have never known about the genocide. There was no reason for her to know, safely contained within the palace walls. Her proximity to power distances her from the margins she grew up in. But because of her cousin Mordecai, Esther's worlds collide. As I mentioned, this sermon came in a series about speaking from the margins. And one of the reasons that I was asked to speak about Esther is because of my perspective as a white woman. And in those two words, white woman is a mixture of power and marginalization. And Esther also lives with a mixture of power and marginalization, a different mixture, but a mixture nonetheless. And as a result of that mixture, trying to navigate power dynamics responsibly gets a little messy. When do I stand up for myself and when do I sit down? When do I speak up and when do I listen? When do I lead and when do I follow? For myself as a white woman, it's a complicated mess. And that's just talking about race and gender. What about class, education, citizenship, sexual orientation, physical and mental ability, even just our roles within our families and the congregation and our workplaces? Trying to live a responsibly powered life, one that can differentiate between oppressive power and liberating power, is messy. And I see some of that messiness at play in Esther too, because here we have Esther, an orphan, raised by her cousin Mordecai, a woman, ethnically other, being Jewish is as much an ethnic designation as a religious one. But she's queen of an empire, the largest empire the world had ever seen at that point. She was the most powerful woman on earth. So, we left Mordecai outside the gate in sackcloth and ashes, and Esther in the palace is communicating with him via a servant. I'm going to start reading from chapter 4, verse 8. This is right in the middle of Mordecai telling the servant what's going on. This is in the NRSV. Mordecai also gave the servant a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, and charge her to go to the king to make supplication to him and entreat him for her people. Mordecai says, Esther, this is the order for our genocide. This is our death warrant. You need to go to the king and talk to him about this. Esther replies, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know. Mordecai, you should know this already. If any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law. All alike are to be put to death. Only if the king holds out the golden scepter to someone may that person live. I myself have not been called to come into the king for 30 days. It's been a while. When Mordecai says, Esther, you gotta do something about this, Esther fires back, there is a glass ceiling in this palace and you know it. We don't usually think of the term glass ceiling with regard to monarchies and kings and queens and royal courts. It's usually more of a corporate ladder that you can or rather can't climb. I think some similar underlying dynamics and prejudices and gender-based barriers may be at work here too. Because between the lines of this verse, Esther is saying, Haman and all of the other top officials, who all happen to be men, they're listed in chapter 1, they can go talk to King Ahasuerus whenever they want. And that already happened in the story. But if anyone else, including me, the queen of all people, if any of the rest of us try to talk to the king without being invited, we die. Unless the king extends his golden scepter. Mordecai, it is not within my power to do what you are asking me to do. I may be the top-ranking woman in this entire empire, but unlike the top male officials, I can't talk to the king, my husband, without an invitation. That is above my pay grade. This is Mordecai's response, paraphrased. Don't think that because you are in the palace, you'll escape this. Don't think that the palace will make an exception for you. Don't think that your Persian mask of an identity will save you. Remember that you're one of us. If you stay silent in the face of this injustice, our deliverance will have to come from somewhere else, and you won't make it. So, how would you rather die? Using your queenly power to hide and try to save your own skin, or using your power to save your people? Caught between a rock and a hard place, Esther is caught between a glass ceiling and a genocide, both of which mean almost certain death. Do you feel the weight of that? For Esther, it's glass ceilings and genocide, but we know that systemic violence can take oh so many different forms, whether it's economic exploitation, white supremacy, xenophobia, homophobia, machismo, colonialism, hypermilitarism, American exceptionalism, or just plain erasure. Parts of Esther's identity place her on the receiving end of systemic violence, and parts of her identity place her on the dealing end of that violence, and now she's stuck. She is staring down the barrel of the gun of empire, but her queenly office places her finger on the trigger. Something's gotta give, and none of her options look good. And then something happens, and we're not quite sure what, but the Esther who answers Mordecai is a very different Esther than the one that was dragged into the palace, who fearfully disowned her ethnic identity in order to blend in for safety. That was Mordecai's advice to her, by the way. He told her to do that. and who was painfully aware of what a queen could and couldn't do. The Esther who answers Mordecai has a much more expansive perspective of the situation at hand that can see beyond herself and beyond her moment and beyond the probable. What could have happened to spark that change in Esther? Who knows? But maybe if we look at what she does afterwards, how she speaks truth to power, we'll get some insight into her turning point. So let's briefly break down what Esther does to address her precarious situation between a glass ceiling and genocide, and then we'll come back to this watershed moment between Esther and Mordecai. Esther lays out a plan of action to talk to Ahasuerus uninvited on behalf of the rest of the Jews. And that plan hits several strategic points, which I'm just going to summarize. So if you want to hear more about any of these, just let me know. I can direct you to other sermons that talk about these more in full. So consider this a small taste. So I suggest you buckle your seatbelts because I'm going to be moving a little quickly. It is time to bring this one in for a landing. Firstly, Esther preaches with her body. And she's not the only one to do so. As I mentioned near the beginning, Esther's story starts with the previous queen, Vashti, making a statement by not showing up when she was supposed to. And that sets the tone for the rest of the book. Esther then shows up when she's not supposed to. And when Esther goes to King Ahasuerus uninvited to work toward a solution for the proposed genocide, she's standing on the shoulders of Vashti. Esther is not the first one to challenge that glass ceiling with Ahasuerus. That one moment when Esther breaks the law to go to Ahasuerus uninvited is not an isolated moment. It has a history. Her eventual success did not come out of nowhere. Secondly, Esther preaches with her words. That she showed up uninvited is a sermon unto itself, but unlike Vashti, Esther needed to speak this time to make sure her disruptive actions would be interpreted correctly by Ahasuerus. She starts her sermon with her body and finishes it with her words to make sure that he gets the message. Esther states her case, and in doing so, she outs herself as Jewish. Hold that thought for about 30 seconds. Thirdly, she sees, speaks, and seeks. Mordecai confronts Esther with a problem, and after some mysterious turning point, Esther can see an alternate outcome. She can imagine another possibility. Then she speaks for the Jews who are unheard in the royal court. They are not voiceless. They are lamenting loud and clear out in the city, but in the palace they are unheard. And then she seeks that alternate outcome by embracing her marginalized social location. She confronts her womanhood, barring her from Ahasuerus's inner circle, and she leans into her Jewishness that is threatened by genocide. When faced with death, Esther fights back boldly with her vulnerability, embracing it so that it becomes her strength. She embraces how she was created. Lastly, Esther was not in this alone. By embracing her Jewishness, she reconnects with her Jewish people and can mobilize them to fast and pray with her before she goes to Ahasuerus. She reestablishes her connections to the margins through her relationship with her cousin Mordecai. Because the depth of her relationship with Mordecai determines how deep her relationship with the rest of the Jews can be. Mordecai is her bridge to the margins. But not just the Jewish people in Susa, Esther also rallies her immediate community in the palace. Her maids fasted with her too. And then her marriage to King Ahasuerus. As Esther spoke to Ahasuerus with both of those communities solidly behind her, she was more open and honest with him than she had ever been. I am not married, but I hear that open and honest communication is awfully important. It is for any relationship, not just marriage. Even though Esther was confronting him about the injustice he had authorized, the work of restoring justice actually strengthened their relationship and made it healthier. Because of their relationship, Esther was quite possibly the only Jew in the empire he would have responded favorably to. Esther had the support of the community in the margins and a relationship with the dominant center of power. It was a relationship that alerted her to the problem and a relationship that helped her find a solution to the problem, an imperfect solution. Both are necessary. So if Esther has any one thing to teach us, it's that the work of justice, the work of God, is longer than any one moment and bigger than any one person. But the funny thing about the book of Esther is that it never mentions God, not once. Some scholars point to chapter 4, verse 14, this deliverance from another quarter, and say, that's God, and other scholars disagree. But I want to draw our attention to two words that I neglected to incorporate into my paraphrase of Mordecai several minutes ago. Two words that come right before his famous, for such a time as this line, who knows? As Esther faces the decision of how she would rather die, her fate may look like it's sealed, but who knows? As she considers the impossibility of overcoming the barriers of the law, her glass ceiling may look impenetrably thick, but who knows? As she bends under the weight of the task before her, it may look like she'll collapse under it alone, but who knows? That question, who knows, leaves open a divine hope, a divine possibility, a divine open-endedness that, as my friend Inez puts it so well, it doesn't have to be this way. To ask who knows is to refuse to accept injustice as it stands because it doesn't have to be this way. To ask who knows is to reject the dominance of domination because it doesn't have to be this way. To ask who knows is to acknowledge the fact that oppression has an upper hand, but not the upper hand, because we know it doesn't have to be this way. Even if God is never mentioned, it doesn't mean that God is absent, because we know the name of God, and it's Emmanuel, God with us. And Emmanuel was born so very far from the halls of power. So may my whiteness tremble, but my womanhood rejoice, that in the face of violence and oppression, it doesn't have to be this way. So we can join in the long struggle against the odds with hope, because with Emmanuel in the game, who knows?